extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes. Now, did your father object in the beginning
no.
to your going?
He made fun of me when I kept talking in high school. He said, most girls that he'd known would say, I'm going to get educated, get married, and have babies. But not Jessie. She's going to get educated in high school and go to Smith College. So he knew that it was in the air, of course.
Did your brother later go to college also?
No, he went a while to Dartmouth. I got him to Dartmouth. But he was not a scholar, and he was not interested in studying. And in the end, he had a big ranch, married a girl with a lot of money, ranch money, and had a big ranch down there, Boone, Colorado.
And your younger sister, did she go to college?
No, she didn't. That's another long story. She was the sweetest and least ambitious member of the whole family, and very domestic, a very beautiful child. I think she must have inherited her looks from my mother. She had blue eyes, and she was just a beautiful little girl, and very sweet and gracious. And after I got to Boston, when I was working with the Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission, she got into a tangle, wanted to do something. She did want to be a musician. And she went to Chicago to try to do that, and that didn't work out. So she'd gone back home, and I wrote and asked her what did she want to do, and she said, well, if she couldn't be a musician, she wanted to be a nurse. And I said, well, in Boston we have the greatest hospital of America, the Massachusetts General. And I sent her the money, and she came on and went in as a nurse and became a great success. And then later, she came to England when I had a very serious illness, and she met on the boat a brilliant Harvard professor. And they had a love affair on the boat, and she married him, and he went on, lived at Harvard, had a very wonderful life.
So you were the only one of the three children that had a college education?
Yeah. That's right.
Were there other girls in that town
Later there was one more old girl that did. But I often think about my father, who had taken the whole thing rather not very seriously. In the first place, he didn't see why I couldn't go to school in Colorado instead of Northampton, Massachusetts. He didn't see that importance. But after I graduated, I was walking along the street with him one day, and he met one of his business associates, and this man said, well, he said, is this the daughter that graduated from Smith College? And my father said, yes. And he said to my father, well, how did you happen to send her to Smith College? And my father said, well, I thought the best was none too good for her. So that was that.
Were there other girls in that town who had been going to college, or were you among the first?
I'm among the first. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, to go to Smith College and get into that beautiful New England atmosphere, cultural atmosphere, just completely altered my life, of course. Took me out of that pioneer background that I'd come from, and got me into the cultural world of America. Changed my life.
Now, what was your course of study like at Smith?
Well, that's interesting. I got into the first class in psychology that was taught in America. The very first class. I got into that, I think it was in junior year, and I went crazy over psychology. So I took psychology, philosophy, aesthetics, ethics, and logic. I took every course in that philosophical department. I didn't understand it very well, the philosophy, but I adored it, and in the end it became a tremendous part of my life in London. You don't want to go into that now, but I did want to learn to write, and so I took a writing course. But we had a teacher, she was not a very good teacher, and the only thing she was interested in were students that could do poetry and fancy writing. And I wasn't that type of person. Once or twice I wrote something that she said had a possibility, but I didn't get very far with it. And I was dying for a speech course, and there were no speech courses. And there are none at Smith College yet. All they did was to test you, and if you didn't stutter, then you didn't need speech. And I went into the speech class that they taught, and it was entirely on enunciation and diction. Well, I had a voice you could hear a mile, but what I wanted to learn was how to put things together, how to get material over, how to express it, how to do it. And there was no such class there. So I don't know what else I took. I took a lot of history. I took a course in Bible study that was very interesting. And I wouldn't make any dates at Smith at all, because of course Amherst boys go up there in the Yale and Harvard and Dartmouth, and the girls all had dates for weekends, and I wasn't going to get sidetracked with dates. And so while they were out dating, I was in the library, and just that Smith library just was so beautiful and so filled with great literature. I read all of Bernard Shaw, all of H.G. Wells, and the girls would want me to go to these dances and parties, and I said, no, I'm getting educated, I haven't time. And I never had a date till junior year, when we had our junior prom, as you always do. And one of my best friends from Great Neck, Rhode Island, Great Neck, Long Island, was her boy was coming up, and he wanted to bring his boyfriend. And so she wrote me in on the junior prom, and his name was Horace Lyon of Lyon's Tooth Powder. And he reeked with money. He was a very rich boy, and later came to Colorado and wanted to marry me. But I was still busy getting educated and getting a career, so I didn't want to get married.
Was there any particular teachers at Smith that you remember having great influence on you? This is a period when there were a lot of socialists around, weren't there? And people were...
Well, frankly, I was disappointed in my teachers. In my opinion, they weren't very interesting. They had... what I longed for was women teachers to give me a plan for my span of life. We sat around our rooms hours on end. How are we going to carry on with this intellectual life and development and yet have a home and children? And there was nobody there that had done it. There was nobody there interested in homes and children. And there was no guidance. And as a matter of fact, it was not a healthy environment in a way. There was a great deal of homosexual work going on there. And then we had a terrible tragedy in our class that nobody had coped with. Now, that wouldn't happen today, of course. I'm sure all those colleges have psychiatric departments and psychiatric help. But there was a girl in our class who was a very masculine type of girl who was head of the basketball program and marvelous player and a very beautiful, sweet, delicate, typically feminine girl. And the two of them lived together. And this, her roommate went up to Dartmouth, and she loved boyfriends, and so she went up to Dartmouth to dance a great deal and for weekends. And a brilliant boy in Dartmouth fell in love with her. Perfectly brilliant, gifted young boy. But her roommate was determined to break that up. And so when the summer came, I think it was in junior year, they went to Chicago where the roommate lived. And this young man lived in Chicago. And they found out that his mother had been in a mental institution. So she persuaded her roommate to cancel the engagement. And when they came back to college that fall, he wrote frantic letters. He felt that he was, that she was being influenced, you see. And she got her to send the letters back unopened. And finally, the girl, this lovely girl, was also an actress, and we had Midsummer Night's Dream for our play. And she had the lead part of the lovely girl that danced and sang. I can't remember what that was called. And she was the leading one of the Midsummer Night's Dream. And one day we were all looking out of the window, and the whole campus was rocked with this love affair, because the boy had come to town and was hanging around, had left Dartmouth, trying to see her. And she was sneaking out the back door and dodging him. And we thought that was terribly exciting and a great love affair. Took any interest in it, or knew what to do, or tried to do anything. And the result was that as we leaned out of the window one day, we saw her coming along, and he met her. And she was swinging along, gay as a lark, and he had his hat pulled down over his head. And they walked in and across and into the center of the campus when he shot her and himself on the campus. Well, I was very critical of that affair. I said, that's what's the matter with this college. There's no humanity in it. There's no guidance for women, the guidance that we need. And there isn't any there yet much. Mm. I'll tell you that.
Were all of the faculty men?
No, oh no, there were a lot of women on the faculty. But they were mostly unmarried women, not... Some of them, I expect, were very good teachers. There were a few good teachers. I know who my greatest teacher was. It was the one that taught psychology. He was great. He was simply great. I just adored the whole thing. But I didn't fall for many of the others. They didn't even touch my high school teacher.
Now, the main problem was then that you wanted to still be able to pursue some sort of career or
interest. That's right.
And figure out how you could both do that and become married.
And be married, yeah. How could I coordinate it from all I knew of married life? You spent your life having babies, washing diapers, cooking, and therefore how are you going to keep up with your intellectual life? No one had the answer. They haven't the answer yet. But I found the answer in London. And I'm giving a lecture on it next Thursday out at Cal State in Northridge.
Now, did most of the other girls feel this way, or did they just assume they were going to get married and forget
they
about any
They weren't as upset about it as I was. I upset them a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. But they weren't, you see, my mother had said, get educated. She didn't say, be a housekeeper. So I had no image of it being a housekeeper, except inside me, I wanted to have a baby. I wanted to have children.
So Ed Smith, you really already had a very strongly developed feminist consciousness. Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I was a feminist from the beginning.
Did you have any idea what it was that you wanted to do at that point, or you were just still very...
Well, something happened that guided me. I have been blessed all my life with running into that marvelous guidance. In Colorado, out on a ranch, there was an Englishman, a graduate of Oxford University. And he had a red-haired daughter that he had entirely educated till she got to the senior year in high school. And in that I went, Central High School it was called, where I went. And the one girl, this red-haired girl, rode horseback, brought up on this ranch, and he had the philosophy that a girl should be herself, do what she wanted to do. Typical English people are a lot more liberal about women, incidentally, than we are, than our country is, because we're still held down by the pioneer image that the men had to have a woman run a home or they couldn't have homes. The British have all kinds of way of running homes. They don't depend on one woman to do the whole thing, you see. So he brought up this girl, Mary Thornton, brilliant, beautiful girl. And she got into the high school just for the senior year to graduate because she wanted to go back east and be a nurse. And the one girl she picked out for a friend was myself. She couldn't see anybody else. So she began inviting me out to their ranch for weekends in senior year. And in the process, I began telling them what my home problem was. So this Englishman was, the whole home was filled with English things and, well, an Oxford graduate, you see. The reason he went to Colorado was that he was the younger son of a titled family. And in England in those days, and it still is so, that the older son inherits the title and the estate, and the younger son has to be either a minister or a soldier. And this Englishman didn't want to be a minister, and he didn't want to be a soldier, so he came to America to be what he wanted to be. And he had this ranch. So when I was a sophomore in college, he asked me, I went out for the weekend, and he said, and he had okayed my getting to Smith, too, of course. He said, what was I going to do when I got through? And I said, well, most of the Smith girls teach. Well, he said, you aren't going to be any good as a teacher, of a typical teacher fitting into the machinery of teaching. But he said, your father's a brilliant businessman, and you've probably inherited a lot of his ability. So he said, why don't you spend your summers learning shorthand typewriting? Well, I said, I've never heard of a Smith girl learning shorthand type. I was beginning to be very top-lofty, you see. And so anyway, when I got back after junior year, my father and mother, my stepmother and father decided that as I was having this vast sum of money spent on me, $1,200 a year, that in the summer I could come home and take the place of the weekly cleaner that came. See? You know, why not? I, instead of having a weekly cleaner do all over the house and all the washing and ironing, I would do it. At that point, I felt called upon to learn shorthand typewriting right away. So I beat it down to the little school there, and the minute I hit that typewriter, I found I didn't know how to spell. So I began getting a little respectful. And I finally, I worked like a dog on it. I saw that it was a tremendous thing. It was hard work. So the next summer I went back, I put in another summer on it. And when I went back to Smith and told my friends what I was doing, they, well, what did I want to learn shorthand typewriting? You know, just be an office secretary? Well, I mean, really, a Smith girl, a secretary? You see, well, by this time I'd got very respectful for the whole thing. So when I went back after I'd graduated, I suggested that I work my father's office and keep his office work going. He never had a secretary. And then I would take in shorthand typewriting from the lawyers in the building. And that way I'd earn some extra money. So he agreed, and I did a lot of, not very well I didn't do it, because I'm not a good typist yet. But I did earn a lot of money, quite a lot, and there was no typist there, that certainly none that had a college education. And so at the end of that second summer, I said, told my father I wanted to go back to Reunion. And I made him pay me too. He didn't like that very well either. And neither did my stepmother like it very well. And I lived at home and ate and all, but I didn't do very much work. And so I went back to Reunion, and then I heard that one of the English teachers had opened an employment bureau for business girls instead of teachers. So I beat it to her office, and she said, I hear that you have this employment bureau. And she said, well, what can you do, Jesse? And I said, I'm a legal secretary. And she said, what? You're the first girl to enter that room with a business training. I've got 100 jobs for you. Where are they? All over the place, she said. I haven't got anybody to get them for. And so one of them was the Macmillan Publishing Company. And in September, I went down as assistant to the head of the college textbook department with my own secretary and file clerk.
Now, then, that was in New York.
That was in New York.
Now, was her office in New York?
What?
Was her office in New York?
Oh, no, she was at Smith College.
She was
an English teacher, and she'd sent word out that she was going to supply people, college Smith graduates, with jobs. And I got $14 a week in New York City.
And what did you do exactly at that job?
Well, I was assistant to the head of the college textbook department. That meant that every time a college book was published, I had back on my desk 400 college catalogs, and I had to find the courses that would fit that book. And then I had to write to the man that had the course and tell him about the book, and would he like a sample copy? And of course, if he liked the sample copy, 400 books would go, or how many, to that school, you see. So it was very fascinating. I didn't even know how to write a letter. See, here I'd taken this English course. I couldn't even write a simple letter. So my boss had to teach me how to write those letters. He was quite happy, though, with the way I did it. And I had a secretary and file clerk, and it was terribly hard work.
What was your work schedule like? Was it a 48-hour week, or how?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Regular. It fitted in with the publishing business. And, of course, it was turned out a great experience to get that inside look into a big publishing, one of the biggest publishing firms in New York, and a British firm.
Were there other women working there, or only
a secretary? Oh, yes. Oh, no. Well, then I said to him, $14 a week is going to be difficult for me to live on in New York City. When do I get more money? And he said, at Christmas, if I would make good. So at Christmas, my envelope had another dollar in it. So I took it in and I said, is this my increase? See, I held it up. He said, well, Miss Haver, I think you take a very unfortunate attitude. He said, I came here for $10 a week. And I said, I'm told now you're getting $2,400 a year. How soon will I get that? Well, really, Miss Haver, we have Jessie Reed here, and she has edited a whole series of books. She's been here 25 years. She gets $25 a week, and she's a Wellesley graduate. So, $25 a week, you see, after 25 years was the status. So I met Jessie Reed in the restroom later, and I said, Miss Reed, do you know what you're doing to the women in this firm? With my knees knocking. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, every time we want more money, I'm getting $14 a week. We're told about you and how you've been here 25 years, and you're getting $25 a week and have edited a whole series of books. What? She said. What do you mean? I said, I'm telling you what happens and what you're doing to us. And she said, why, Miss Haver, she said, I have a little apartment around the corner. I have no family. I love this sort of work. I was born for it. And I never dreamed that I was setting a standard for this whole firm. She said, that's terrible. She went up to the president and she said, I've come to tell you that beginning Monday I want $6,000 a year, and I want royalties for all the books I've edited. And he said, Miss Reed, have you lost your mind? No, she said, I just found it. She was a modest little quiet woman. Well, he said, you're fired as of next month. You know what happened? The next Monday, five publishers were there in the office after her, and she went out at $6,000. And I was still getting $14 for my efforts. So I knew my days there were limited at what I'd done. So I went up Fifth Avenue, and by that time, six women's colleges had organized an employment bureau. And I went in, told them what had happened, and they said, "Goody! We knew this was going on in that publishing firm, but we didn't have the facts. Sure, we have another job. How would you like to be secretary of the Pulitzer School of Journalism that's just started at Columbia?" And I said, "Can I live on the campus?" "Yes, you can live on the campus." And instead of getting $14 a week, I would get $85 a month. 4 × 4 = 16, 4 × 4 = 5, 6. From 56 to 85. So they sent me up to Professor Cunliffe, and the next week I had the job at Columbia University. First secretary of the Pulitzer School of Journalism.
And what was that job exactly?
Well, I was to be the secretary of Cunliffe, and that was a typing job. In the morning, I was to be secretary to Talcott Williams, who was a very famous newspaper man at the School of Journalism, in the afternoon. And I moved to Columbia University. Well, my experience there was rather hair-raising, too. Cunliffe was a typical Britisher, and well-organized, and had a well-organized office. But Talcott Williams was a typical, hectic newspaper man. He was not used to the academic atmosphere at all. And so he would spend the afternoon talking to people, interviewing people, and then at 5 o'clock he'd ask me to get my book and stay there till 10 at night doing his mail, not even giving me time off to get dinner or go away or anything. So after about a month of this, the question was never raised about was it the right thing to do. I asked Professor Cunliffe about it, what was happening, and I said, "I can't get along without my dinner, and then when I get it, it's so late at night, and I have to buy it, and I'm paying for my dinner at Whittier Hall." "Oh," Cunliffe said, "you're not supposed to work like that at all." So I said, "Well, what'll I do?" And he said, "Go and tell the secretary of the university." So I told him, and he said, "Oh, Mrs. Butler, people here in this university, we don't work like that." I said, "That's what I thought, why I wanted to come here." He says, "You're supposed to go at 5 o'clock. So the next day, I tackled this happy old man. He was a horrid old man. He told dirty stories, and he was a nasty kind of man. He was awful. So next day, when he came in, I told him that I'd not been able to get my dinner, and he said, "Well, Miss Haver, you're not very strong, are you?" "No," I said, "when I don't get my dinner, I'm not strong." And I found later he had killed off secretaries all his life who needed the jobs, you see, and never dared complain. So I said, "Well, I've spoken to the secretary of the university. Will this upset him?" And he says, "I'm supposed to leave at 5 o'clock. And he said, "Well, this is very hard on me, very. But we'll see what we can do about it." So the next day, he went on as usual, and at 5 told me to get my book. Instead of getting my book, I got my hat and left. And the next day he said, "You left without my permission." I said, "Mr. Williams, I explained to you. I have to have my dinner, and we're supposed to go at 5 o'clock. So after that, he completely changed until I went home for my holiday to Colorado, and then he sent me a letter and fired me while I was in Colorado.
That was it. And you've been there how long at that point?
2 years. So I came back in the fall without, and came into my job, you know, as if I belonged there. And I said I had to have a couple of weeks to find another job. I looked him right in the eye. He turned completely yellow. He was scared stiff. He had no guts at all. I found that out, see. So then I went to the employment bureau again, told them what had happened. They said, that's all right, we've got a gorgeous job for you. And I said, what is it? And he says, to go to the Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission and be a statistician and an investigator. But I said, I don't know anything about statistics. Well, nobody does. That's their trouble. But they want a college woman, and you've had Smith graduate they like, and the woman that is the head of it is a professor at Mount Holyoke College, and she'll be here tomorrow, and you come down and see her. And I was to get $1,400. Now, what was that for the year? Yes, $1,400 mm-hmm. for the year. Imagine that. So I went down the next, what I did, that was key. I had the interview with him Friday. Saturday or Sunday, I spent the entire day on the beach. What do you call the famous?
Coney Island.
Yeah, Coney Island. I spent the entire day lying in the sun. I was awful tired and upset about all this business. And I got all brown. And then I went to the slickest hat woman in New York and bought the cutest hat you ever saw. And when I swung into that employment office, boy, I looked like $1,000,000. I was all tanned and I had this, I can see the hat, it was a beautiful hat. And she just fell for me, this teacher, employed me at once. And the next month or so, I was to get up to Boston. Well, I got up there into the office of the Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission. And meanwhile, she found a little, stuffy, typical New England woman who was a trained statistician. And now she didn't want me anymore. She found somebody better than me. See, I wasn't trained. So, she had her on the job when I got there. Left New York, all my clothes, everything up in Boston. And so, I looked at this little girl. She was a short girl and typical flat-heeled shoes and typical New England. That's a style of woman that's just unique, you know. She had no charm, no personality, just a little plugger. And I went into the office and they gave me a piece of paper and some figures, and I'm rotten on math, and I misspelled the list of figures. And so I was summoned into the office and fired. I wasn't going to fit in the job. Well, I said, you can't do that. I've left New York, and give me one thing to do that without any training or anything and judge me on that score. You can't do that. Well, they were very sorry about it. They felt very sorry. I could go back to New York and just get another job. So you know what I did? I took that little mousy girl out to a hotel dining room. She'd never been in a hotel dining room. You know, she was always saving money. She lived with her father, and she never had any kind of a life. I took her out to lunch. Her name was Helen Hill. And I said, now look, dear, you can't do this to me. I said, you can't do that kind of thing. That was unfair. I never came here as a trained statistician. I can't add at all. But I said, I want to tell you something. I've got something you haven't got. So if you and I gang up together, we can do something to that office that nobody else can do. And she said, well, what was that? Well, I said, you're a shark on these figures and on these statistics, and you've done it. But I said, we're going to have 13 people in that office to work under us, and I know how to get people to work for me and love it. And that'll be my fort, see? And you handle the figures and teach me how to handle them. And we'll have a partnership that they can't breathe without. So she said, well, maybe that was, maybe she could do that. So we went back and had an interview with Miss Hughes and put it up to her, and she said, well, she'd give it a try. And meanwhile, they had three commissioners there, and one of them was LaRue Brown, who'd been an assistant attorney general in Washington, brilliant lawyer. And he said to Miss Hughes, you cannot do this kind of thing, bring this woman up here and give her an unfair test like that. I won't stand for it. So she had to keep me there. I was there 4 years.
And tell me about your, when you were in New York, the 3 years you were in New York working, your living situation, what it was like to be a single woman, for instance, at that time, where you lived, the kinds of things that you did.
Well, of course, whenever anyone has spent 4 years in the environment of a beautiful college, you know, with the companionship and the intellectual environment and the great plays that came to Northampton. I'd never seen any plays in my life. I remember Natsimova came in that great play of that great feminist play.
Ibsen's
feminist play.
The Doll's House?
The Doll's House. I saw that there. All the great plays, to be in that beautiful campus and the beautiful meals and the social life and the companionship, to have 4 years of that, and then to be jerked back to a hick town like Pueblo, which is a factory town, and in that day a very undeveloped town socially. So I'd suffered agony those 2 years I was in Pueblo. And then to get back into the Macmillan Publishing Company and live in a horrible boarding house up on Madison Avenue, where men and women lived together. They had good food there, but it was a cheap boarding house, and the atmosphere was lurid, you know, to anybody that was cultured. I had a room up on the top floor, and then I have an experience there. Right next to me, there was a strange woman, I just had glanced her going down to the bathroom, who was writing. And one night, I heard her crying violently. And so I went into her room, and she was the author of a whole string of paperback novels. And in a minute I'll think of her name. She'd written a dozen of cheap paperback novels. And in the midst of her writing, she was drinking heavily and had great coffee there that she was pouring down her throat and drinking. And she was screaming and crying this night because the heroine of her story had just had a baby in her story and put the baby into a drawer, a dresser drawer, with a pillow. And somebody forgot and shoved the door shut, and the baby was smothered. And she was crying over this baby. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. She'd had a daughter who had married a very rich man and lived out on Long Island and never went to see her, and the daughter never came to see her. But she helped support that daughter and had engineered her into this marriage. You never heard such a story.
That's where
I was living when I was with the Macmillan Company. It was a horrible, dirty, unclean atmosphere to get into. And right across the street from it, though, was a women's university club. I couldn't afford to live there, but I did join it. And I occasionally went over there and ate just to get out of the filth where I was. So that was a terrible experience. Then, of course, the minute I got at Columbia, I got into Whittier Hall, which was a college dormitory. and had lovely meals and parties and dances, and I met a lot of people. And I finally met a very clever woman, an educated woman, who had a friend that was a owner of a publishing firm down in Lower New York. And she was like some of the famous French women. She was a hostess in her beautiful apartment of a lot of the intellectual, political, and interesting people in New York. So this woman took me to this woman's home, and they took a tremendous fancy to me because I was so queer. I was from Pueblo, Colorado, and I wouldn't drink and wouldn't smoke. And they took me as an exhibit, and once a month, she and this group of, an ex-governor was in there, and lawyers were in that group, and once a month they would start out eating somewhere, and during the whole night till 3 a.m, we'd eat in 5 places, all over New York. Well, I adored it. I saw New York life as it was, and I kept myself, I never would take a drink. And so they thought this was a spree. And they would say to the waiters, we can't make her drink, you just have to bring her ginger ale. She comes from Pueblo, Colorado. She's impossible. And they just adored me because I was so unique. So one day one of my Smith friends, Francis Wintringham, had hunted me up there at Whittier Hall. And I was telling her about these people, and she said, well, Jesse, she said, my Lord, I've lived here all my life, and I've never known a crowd like that. Let me go with you sometime. And Frances was an artist and a very interesting girl, one of the first women I ever saw that smoked. She always went out in the back somewhere with somebody else and was such a devil, she smoked. So anyway, I took her down to this party. And I thought, well, boys, they'd love her because she'd fit right in, you see. Well, they hated her. The next time they said, don't bring us anybody more like that woman. But I said, she's a New Yorker. That's the trouble with her. She's like everybody else. She isn't from Pueblo, Colorado. So for 2 years, I had a lark. And it was very, a lot of fun, you know, to see the wheels go around. And some of these men would say, you know, Jesse, you ought to get into life. You're not getting into life. I said, I'm in life. I'm in all the life I want. And they said, oh, no, but they mean I ought to have a little sex, you see. I pretended I didn't know what they were talking about, you know. And I had a gay time, really. In that time, I ate and all, and they paid all the bills just to have me around. For some reason. Then my sister, this Emily, she came to New York. So I told her about this crowd, and when I got home that night, I found her in a black dress that she'd bought, slit up to the side with sparkles down her legs this way, see? And I took her down to the party, and they started dancing with her. And my Lord, did they have a ball. And so did she with this dress and all, you know, a sexy dress. And they wanted to know where I'd got this sister. And why had I kept her undercover all these years? So, anyway, that's what happened.